This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Chip in Tampa, Florida, on February 12, 2006. Don Quixote, Volume 1, by Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra, translated by John Ormsby, Part 1, Translator's Preface. 1. About this translation. It was with considerable reluctance that I abandoned, in favor of the present undertaking, what had long been a favorite project, that of a new edition of Shelton's Don Quixote, which has now become a somewhat scarce book. There are some, and I confess myself to be one, for whom Shelton's racy old version with all its defects has a charm that no modern translation, however skillful or correct, could possess. Shelton had the inestimable advantage of belonging to the same generation as Cervantes. Don Quixote had to him a vitality that only a contemporary could feel. It cost him no dramatic effort to see things as Cervantes saw them. There is no anachronism in his language. He put the Spanish of Cervantes into the English of Shakespeare. Shakespeare himself most likely knew the book. He may have carried it home with him in his saddlebags to Stratford on one of his last journeys, and under the mulberry tree at New Place joined hands with a kindred genius in its pages. But it was soon made plain to me that to hope for even a moderate popularity for Shelton was vain. His fine old crusted English would no doubt be relished by a minority, but it would only be a minority. His warmest admirers must admit that he is not a satisfactory representative of Cervantes. His translation of the first part was very hastily made and was never revised by him. It has all the freshness and vigor, but also a full measure of the faults of a hasty production. It is often very literal, barbarously literal frequently, but just as often very loose. He had evidently a good colloquial knowledge of Spanish, but apparently not much more. It never seems to occur to him that the same translation of a word will not suit in every case. It is often said that we have no satisfactory translation of Don Quixote. To those who are familiar with the original, it savors of truism or platitude to say so, for, in truth, there can be no thoroughly satisfactory translation of Don Quixote into English or any other language. It is not that the Spanish idioms are so utterly unmanageable, or that the untranslatable words, numerous enough, no doubt, are so superabundant, but rather that the sententious terseness to which the humor of the book owes its flavor is peculiar to Spanish, and can at best be only distantly imitated by any other tongue. The history of our English translations of Don Quixote is instructive. Shelton's, the first in any language, was made apparently about 1608, but was not published until 1612. This, of course, was only the first part. It had been asserted that the second, published in 1620, is not the work of Shelton, but there is nothing to support the assertion, save the fact that it has less spirit, less of what we generally understand by go about it than the first, which would be only natural if the first were the work of a young man writing Corrente Calamo, and the second that of a middle-aged man writing for a bookseller. On the other hand, it is closer and more literal. The style is the same, the very same translations or mistranslations occur in it, and it is extremely unlikely that a new translator would, by suppressing his name, have allowed Shelton to carry off the credit. In 1687, John Phillips, Milton's nephew, produced a Don Quixote, made English, he says, according to the humor of our modern language. His Quixote is not so much a translation as a travesty, and a travesty that, for coarseness, vulgarity, and buffoonery, is almost unexampled even in the literature of that day. Ned Ward's Life and Noble Adventures of Don Quixote, merrily translated into Hudibrastic verse, 1700, can scarcely be reckoned a translation, but it serves to show the light in which Don Quixote was regarded at the time. A further illustration may be found in the version published in 1712 by Peter Motu, who had then recently combined tea-dealing with literature. It is described as translated from the original by several hands, but if so, all Spanish flavor has entirely evaporated under the manipulation of the several hands. The flavor that it has, on the other hand, is distinctly Franco-Cockney. Anyone who compares it carefully with the original will have little doubt that it is a concoction from Shelton and the French of Filliot de Saint-Martin, eked out by borrowings from Phillips, whose mode of treatment it adopts. It is, to be sure, more decent and decorous, but it treats Don Quixote in the same fashion as a comic book, and cannot be made too comic. To attempt to improve the humor of Don Quixote by the infusion of Cockney flippancy and facetiousness, as Motteux's operators did, is not merely an impertinence, like larding a sirloin of prize beef, but an absolute falsification of the spirit of the book, and it is a proof of the uncritical way in which Don Quixote is generally read, that this worse-than-worthless translation, worthless as failing to represent, worse-than-worthless as misrepresenting, should have been favored as it has been. It had the effect, however, of bringing out a translation undertaken and executed in a very different spirit, that of Charles Gervas, the portrait painter and friend of Pope, Swift, Arbuthnot, and Gay. Gervas has been allowed little credit for his work. Indeed, it may be said none, for it is known to the world in general as Jarvis's. It was not published until after his death, and the printers gave the name according to the current pronunciation of the day. It has been the most freely used and the most freely abused of all the translations. It has seen far more editions than any other. It is admitted on all hands to be by far the most faithful, and yet nobody seems to have a good word to say for it or for its author. Gervas, no doubt, prejudiced readers against himself in his preface, where, among many true words about Shelton, Stevens, and Motteux, he rashly and unjustly charges Shelton with having translated not from the Spanish, but from the Italian version of Francisconi, which did not appear until 10 years after Shelton's first volume. A suspicion of incompetence, too, seems to have attached to him, because he was by profession a painter, and a mediocre one, although he has given us the best portrait we have of Swift, and this may have been strengthened by Pope's remark that he translated Don Quixote without understanding Spanish. He has been also charged with borrowing from Shelton, whom he disparaged. It is true that in a few difficult or obscure passages he has followed Shelton and gone astray with him, but for one case of this sort there are 50 where he is right and Shelton wrong. As for Pope's dictum, anyone who examines Gervas's version carefully, side by side with the original, will see that he was a sound Spanish scholar, incomparably a better one than Shelton, except, perhaps, in mere colloquial Spanish. He was, in fact, an honest, faithful, and painstaking translator, and he has left a version which, whatever its shortcomings may be, is singularly free from errors and mistranslations. The charge against it is that it is stiff, dry, wooden, in a word, and no one can deny that there is a foundation for it. But it may be pleaded for Gervas that a good deal of this rigidity is due to his abhorrence of the light, flippant, jocose style of his predecessors. He was one of the few, very few, translators that have shown any apprehension of the unsmiling gravity which is the essence of the Quixotic humor. It seems to him a crime to bring Cervantes forward, smirking and grinning at his own good things, and to this may be attributed in great measure the aesthetic abstinence from everything savouring of liveliness, which is the characteristic of his translation. In most modern editions, it should be observed, his style has been smoothed and smartened, but without any reference to the original Spanish, so that it is as if he has been made to read more agreeably, he has also been robbed of his chief merit of fidelity. Smollett's version, published in 1755, may almost be counted as one of these. At any rate, it is plain that in its construction Gervas' translation was very freely drawn upon, and very little, or probably no heed, given to the original Spanish. The later translations may be dismissed in a few words. George Kelly's, which appeared in 1769, printed for the translator, was an impudent imposture, being nothing more than Motteux's version, with a few of the words here and there artfully transposed. Charles Wilmot's, in 1774, was only an abridgment, like Florian's, but not so skilfully executed, and the version published by Miss Smirk in 1818 to accompany her brother's plates was merely a patchwork production made out of former translations. On the latest, Mr. A.J. Duffield's, it would be in every sense of the word impertinent in me to offer an opinion here. I had not even seen it when the present undertaking was proposed to me, and since then I may say vidi tantum, having for obvious reasons resisted the temptation which Mr. Duffield's reputation and comely volumes hold out to every lover of Cervantes. From the foregoing history of our translations of Don Quixote, it will be seen that there are a good many people, provided they get the mere narrative of it with its full complement of facts, incidents, and adventures served up to them in the form that amuses them, care very little whether that form is the one in which Cervantes originally shaped his ideas. On the other hand, it is clear that there are many who desire to have not merely the story he tells, but the story as he tells it, so far at least as differences of idiom and circumstances permit, who will give a preference to the conscientious translator, even though he may have acquitted himself somewhat awkwardly. But, after all, there is no real antagonism between the two classes. There is no reason why what pleases the one should not please the other, or why a translator who makes it his aim to treat Don Quixote with the respect due to a great classic should not be as acceptable even to the careless reader as the one who treats it as a famous old jest-book. It is not with the question of caviar to the general, or, if it is, the fault rests with him who makes it so. The method by which Cervantes won the ear of the Spanish people ought, mutatis mundandis, to be equally effective with the great majority of English readers. At any rate, even if there are readers to whom it is a matter of indifference, fidelity to the method is as much a part of the translator's duty as fidelity to the matter. If he can please all parties, so much the better, but his first duty is to those who look to him for as faithful a representation of his author as it is in his power to give them, faithful to the letter so long as fidelity is practical, faithful to the spirit so far as he can make it. My purpose here is not to dogmatize on the rules of translation, but to indicate those who I have followed, or at least tried to the best of my ability to follow, in the present instance. One which, it seems to me, cannot be too rigidly followed in translating Don Quixote is to avoid everything that savours of affectation. The book itself is, indeed, in one sense, a protest against it, and no man abhorred it more than Cervantes. For this reason, I think, any temptation to use antiquated or obsolete language should be resisted. It is, after all, an affectation, and one for which there is no warrant or excuse. Spanish has probably undergone less change since the 17th century than any language in Europe, and by far the greater and certainly the best part of Don Quixote differs but little in language from the colloquial Spanish of the present day. Except in the tales and Don Quixote's speeches, the translator who uses the simplest and plainest everyday language will almost always be the one who approaches nearest to the original. Seeing that the story of Don Quixote and all its characters and incidents have now been for more than 2.5 centuries familiar as household words in English mouths, it seems to me that the old familiar names and phrases should not be changed without good reason. Of course, a translator who holds that Don Quixote should receive the treatment a great classic deserves will feel himself bound by the injunction laid upon the Morisco in Chapter 9 not to omit or add anything. 2. About Cervantes and Don Quixote. 4 generations had laughed over Don Quixote before it occurred to anyone to ask who and what manner of man was this Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra, whose name is on the title page, and it was too late for a satisfactory answer to the question when it was proposed to add a life of the author to the London edition, published at Lord Carteret's insistence in 1738. All traces of the personality of Cervantes had by that time disappeared. Any floating traditions that may once have existed, transmitted from men who had known him, had long since died out, and of other record there was none. For the 16th and 17th centuries were incurious as to the men of the time, a reproach against which the 19th has at any rate secured itself, if it has produced no Shakespeare or Cervantes. All that Mayans Isiscar, to whom the task was entrusted, or any of those who followed him, Rios, Pelussier, or Navarrete, could do was to eke out the few allusions Cervantes makes to himself in his various prefaces with such pieces of documentary evidence bearing upon his life as they could find. This, however, has been done by the last-named biographer to such good purpose that he has superseded all predecessors. Thoroughness is the chief characteristic of Navarrete's work. Besides sifting, testing, and methodizing with rare patience and judgment what had been previously brought to light, he left, as the saying is, no stone unturned under which anything to illustrate his subject might possibly be found. Navarrete has done all that industry and acumen could do, and it is no fault of his if he has not given us what we want. What Hallam says of Shakespeare may be applied to the almost parallel case of Cervantes. It is not the register of his baptism, nor the draft of his will, nor the orthography of his name that we seek. No letter of his writing, no record of his conversation, no character of him drawn by a contemporary has been produced. It is only natural, therefore, that the biographers of Cervantes, forced to make brick without straw, should have recourse largely to conjecture, and that conjecture should in some instances come by degrees to take the place of established fact. All that I propose to do here is to separate what is matter of fact from what is matter of conjecture, and leave it to the reader's judgment to decide whether the data justify the inference or not. The men whose names by common consent stand in the front rank of Spanish literature, Cervantes, Lope de Vega, Quevedo, Calderón, Garcilaso de Vega, the Mendozas, Gongora, were all men of ancient families, and curiously all except the last of families that trace their origin to the same mountain district in the north of Spain. The family of Cervantes is commonly said to have been of Galician origin, and unquestionably it was in possession of lands in Galicia at a very early date. But I think the balance of the evidence tends to show that the Solar, the original site of the family, was at Cervatos in the northwest corner of Old Castile, close to the junction of Castile, León, and the Asturias. As it happens, there is a complete history of the Cervantes family from the 10th century down to the 17th, extant under the title of Illustrious Ancestry, Glorious Deeds, and Noble Posterity of the Famous Nuño Alfonso Alcaide of Toledo, written in 1648 by the industrious genealogist Rodrigo Méndez Silva, who availed himself of a manuscript genealogy by Juan de Mena, the poet laureate and historiographer of John II. The origin of the name Cervantes is curious. Nuño Alfonso was almost as distinguished in the struggle against the Moors in the reign of Alfonso VII as the Cid had been a half-century before in that of Alfonso VI, and was rewarded by divers grants of land in the neighborhood of Toledo. On one of his acquisitions, about 2 leagues from the city, he built himself a castle which he called Cervatos, because he was the lord of the Solar of Cervatos in the Montana, as the mountain region extending from the Basque provinces to León was always called. At his death in battle in 1143, the castle passed by will to his son Alfonso Muño, who, as territorial or local surnames were then coming into vogue in place of the simple patronymic, took the additional name of Cervatos. his eldest son Pedro succeeded him in the possession of the castle, and followed his example in adopting the name, an assumption at which the younger son Gonzalo seems to have taken umbrage. Everyone who has paid even a flying visit to Toledo will remember the ruined castle that crowns the hill above the spot where the bridge of Alcantara spans the gorge of the Tagus, and with its broken outline and crumbling walls makes such an admirable pendant to the square, solid Alcazar, towering over the city roofs on the opposite side. It was built, or as some say, restored, by Alfonso VI, shortly after his occupation of Toledo in 1085, and called by him San Servando, after a Spanish martyr, a name subsequently modified into San Servan, in which form it appears in the Poem of the Cid. San Cervantes with an S and San Cervantes with a C, with regard to which the last handbook of Spain warns its readers against the supposition that it has anything to do with the author of Don Quixote. Ford, as all know who have taken him for a companion and counsellor on the roads of Spain, is seldom wrong in matters of literature or history. In this instance, however, he is in error. It has everything to do with the author of Don Quixote, for it is, in fact, these old walls that have given to Spain the name she is proudest of today. Gonzalo, above mentioned, it may be readily conceived, did not relish the appropriation by his brother of a name to which he himself had an equal right, for although nominally taken from the castle, it was in reality derived from the ancient territorial possessions of the family, and to distinguish himself from his brother, he took as a surname the name of the castle on the bank of the Tagus, in the building of which, according to a family tradition, his great-grandfather had a share. Both brothers founded families. The Cervantes branch had more tenacity. It sent offshoots in various directions, Andalusia, Estremadura, Galicia, and Portugal, and produced a goodly line of men distinguished in the service of the church and the state. Gonzalo himself, and apparently a son of his, followed Ferdinand III in the great campaign of 1236-48 that gave Cordova and Seville to Christian Spain and penned up the Moors in the kingdom of Granada, and his descendants intermarried with some of the noblest families of the peninsula, and numbered among them soldiers, magistrates, and church dignitaries, including at least two cardinal archbishops. Of the line that settled in Andalusia, Diego de Cervantes, commander of the Order of Santiago, married Juana Alvinanda, daughter of Juan Arias de Saavedra, and had several sons, one of whom, Gonzalo Gomez, corregidor of Jerez and ancestor of the Mexican and Colombian branches of the family, and another, Juan, whose son Rodrigo married Dona Leonor de Cortinas, and by her had four children, Rodrigo, Andrea, Luisa, and Miguel, our author. The pedigree of Cervantes is not without its bearing on Don Quixote. A man who could look back upon an ancestry of genuine knights-errant extending from well nigh the time of Peleo to the siege of Granada was likely to have a strong feeling on the subject of the sham chivalry of the romances. It gives a point, too, to what he says in more than one place about families that have once been great and have tapered away until they have come to nothing, like a pyramid. It was the case with his own. He was born at Alcalá de Henares and baptized in the church of Santa Maria Mayor on the 9th of October, 1547. Of his boyhood and youth we know nothing, unless it be from the glimpse he gives us in the preface to his comedies of himself as a boy, looking on with delight while Lope de Redura and his company set up their rude plank stage in the plaza and acted the rustic farces which he himself afterwards took as a model for his interludes. This first glimpse, however, is a significant one, for it shows the early development of that love of the drama which exercised such an influence on his life, and seems to have grown stronger as he grew older, and of which this very preface, written only a few months before his death, is such a striking proof. He gives us to understand, too, that he was a great reader in his youth, but of this no assurance was needed, for the first part of Don Quixote alone proves the vast amount of miscellaneous reading, romances of chivalry, ballads, popular poetry, chronicles, for which he had no time or opportunity except in the first 20 years of his life, and his misquotations and mistakes in matters of detail are always, it may be noticed, those of a man recalling the reading of his boyhood. Other things besides the drama were in their infancy when Cervantes was a boy. The period of his boyhood was in every way a transition period for Spain. The old chivalrous Spain had passed away. The new Spain was the mightiest power the world had seen since the Roman Empire, and it had not yet been called upon to pay the price of its greatness. By the policy of Ferdinand and Ximenez, the sovereign was made absolute, and the Church and Inquisition adroitly adjusted to keep him so. The nobles, who had always resisted absolutism as strenuously as they had fought the Moors, had been divested of all political power. A like fate had befallen the cities. The free constitutions of Castile and Aragon had been swept away, and the only function that remained to the Cortes was that of granting money at the king's dictation. The transition extended to literature. Men who, like Garcilaso de la Vega and Diego Huarto de Mendoza, followed the Italian wars and brought back from Italy the products of the post-Renaissance literature, which took root and flourished, and even threatened to extinguish the native growths. Damon and Thyrsis, Phyllis and Chloe, have been fairly neutralized in Spain, together with all the devices of pastoral poetry for investing with an air of novelty the idea of a despairing shepherd and inflexible shepherdess. As a set-off against this, the historical and traditional ballads, and the true pastorals, the songs and ballads of peasant life, were being collected assiduously and printed in the cancionarios that succeeded one another with increasing rapidity. But the most noble consequence, perhaps, of the spread of printing was the flood of romances of chivalry that had continued to pour from the press ever since García Ordóñez de Montalvo had resuscitated Amadis of Gaul at the beginning of the century. For a youth fond of reading, solid or light, there could have been no better spot in Spain than Alcalá de Henares in the middle of the 16th century. It was then a busy, populous university town, something more than the enterprising rival of Salamanca, and altogether a very different place from melancholy, silent, deserted Alcalá the traveller sees now as he goes from Madrid to Saragossa. Theology and medicine may have been the strong points of the university, but the town itself seems to have inclined rather to the humanities and light literature, and, as a producer of books, Alcalá was already beginning to compete with the older presses of Toledo, Burgos, Salamanca, and Seville. A pendant to the picture Cervantes has given us, his first playgoings might, no doubt, have been often seen in the streets of Alcalá at that time. A bright, eager, tawny-haired boy, peering into a bookshop where the latest volumes lay open to tempt the public, wondering, it may be, what the little book with the woodcut of the blind beggar and his boy could be about, or, with his eyes brimming over with merriment, gazing at one of those preposterous portraits of a knight-errant in outrageous panoply and plumes with which the publishers of chivalry romances love to embellish the title pages of their folios. If the boy was the father of the man, the sense of the incongruous that was strong at 50 was lively at 10, and some such reflections as these may have been the true genesis of Don Quixote. For his more solid education, we are told, he went to Salamanca. But why Rodrigo de Cervantes, who was very poor, should have sent his son to a university 150 miles away when he had one at his own door would be a puzzle, if we had any reason for supposing that he did so. The only evidence is a vague statement by Professor Tomás González that once he saw an old entry of the matriculation of a Miguel de Cervantes. This does not appear to have ever been seen again, but even if it had, and if the date corresponded, it would prove nothing, as there were at least two other Miguels born about the middle of the century. One of them, moreover, a Cervantes Saavedra, a cousin, no doubt, who was a source of great embarrassment to the biographers. That he was a student neither at Salamanca nor at Alcala is best proved by his own works. No man drew more largely on experience than he did, and he has nowhere left a single reminiscence of student life, for the Tia Flingia, if it be his, is not one. Nothing, not even a college joke, to show that he remembered days that most men remember best. All that we know positively about his education is that Juan López de Hoyos, a professor of humanities and belles lettres of some eminence, calls him his dear and beloved pupil. This was in a little collection of verses by different hands on the death of Isabella de Valois, second queen of Philip II, published by the professor in 1569, to which Cervantes contributed four pieces, including an elegy and an epitaph in the form of a sonnet. It is only by a rare chance that a Lycidas finds its way into a volume of this sort, and Cervantes was no Milton. His verses were no worse than such things usually are, so much at least may be said for them. By the time the book appeared, he had left Spain, and, as fate ordered it, for 12 years, the most eventful ones in his life. Julio, afterwards Cardinal Acquaviva, had been sent at the end of 1568 to Philip II by the Pope on a mission partly of condolence, partly political, and on his return to Rome, which was somewhat brusquely expedited by the king, he took Cervantes with him as his camarero, or chamberlain, the office he himself held in the Pope's household. The post would, no doubt, have led to advancement at the papal court, had Cervantes retained it, but in the summer of 1570 he resigned it, and enlisted as a private soldier in Captain Diego Urbina's company, belonging to Don Miguel de Moncada's regiment, but at that time forming a part of the command of Mark Antony Colonna. What impelled him to this step we know not, whether it was distaste for the career before him, or purely military enthusiasm. It may well have been the latter, for it was a stirring time. The events, however, which led to the alliance between Spain, Venice, and the Pope, against the common enemy, the Porte, and to the victory of the combined fleets of Lepanto, belong rather to the history of Europe than to the life of Cervantes. He was one of those who sailed from Messina in September of 1571, under the command of Don John of Austria, but on the morning of the 7th of October, when the Turkish fleet was sighted, he was lying below, ill with fever. At the news that the enemy was in sight, he insisted on taking his post, saying he preferred death in the service of God and the king to health. His galley, the Marquesa, was in the thick of the fight, and before it was all over he had himself received 3 gunshot wounds, 2 in the breast and 1 in the left hand or arm. On the morning after the battle, according to Navarrete, he had an interview with the commander-in-chief, Don John, who was making a personal inspection of the wounded, one result of which was an addition of 3 crowns to his pay, and another, apparently, the friendship of his general. How severely Cervantes was wounded may be inferred from the fact that, with youth of vigorous frame and as cheerful and buoyant a temperament as ever invalid had, he was 7 months in the hospital at Messina before he was discharged. He came out with his left hand permanently disabled. He had lost the use of it, as Mercury told him in the Viejo de Paranaso, for the greater glory of the right. This, however, did not absolutely unfit him for service, and in April of 1572 he joined Manuel Ponce de León's company of Lope de Figueroa's regiment, in which, it seems probable, his brother Rodrigo was serving, and shared in the operations of the next 3 years, including the capture of the Goleta and Tunis. Taking advantage of the lull which followed the recapture of these places by the Turks, he obtained leave to return to Spain, and sailed from Naples in September of 1575 on board the Sun Galley, in company with his brother Rodrigo, Pedro Carrillo de Queseda, late governor of the Goleta, and some others, and furnished with letters from Don John of Austria and the Duke of Sesa, the viceroy of Sicily, recommending him to the king for the command of a company, on account of his services, a dono infelice, as events proved. On the 26th they fell in with a squadron of Algerine galleys, and after a stout resistance were overpowered and carried into Algiers. By means of a ransomed fellow captive, the brothers contrived to inform their family of their condition, and the poor people of Alcala at once strove to raise the ransom money, the father disposing of all he possessed, and the two sisters giving up their marriage portions. But Dali Mami had found on Cervantes the letters addressed to the king by Don John and the Duke of Sesa, and, concluding that his prize must be a person of great consequence, when the money came he refused it scornfully as being altogether insufficient. The owner of Rodrigo, however, was more easily satisfied. Ransom was accepted in his case, and it was arranged between the brothers that he should return to Spain and procure a vessel in which he was to come back to Algiers and take off Miguel and as many of their comrades as possible. This was not the first attempt to escape that Cervantes had made. Soon after the commencement of his captivity, he induced several of his companions to join him in trying to reach Oran, then a Spanish post, on foot. But after the first day's journey, the Moor who had agreed to act as their guide deserted them, and they had no choice but to return. The second attempt was more disastrous. In a garden outside the city on the seashore, he constructed, with the help of the gardener, a Spaniard, a hiding-place, to which he brought, one by one, 14 of his fellow-captives, keeping there in secrecy for several months, and supplying them with food, through a renegade known as El Dorador, the glider. How he, a captive himself, contrived to do all this is one of the mysteries of the story. Wild as the project may appear, it was very nearly successful. The vessel procured by Rodrigo made its appearance off the coast, and under cover of night was proceeding to take off the refugees when the crew, alarmed by a passing fishing boat, had beat a hasty retreat. On renewing the attempt shortly afterwards, they, or a portion of them at least, were taken prisoners, and just as the poor fellows in the garden were exulting in the thought that in a few moments more freedom would be within their grasp, they found themselves surrounded by Turkish troops, horse and foot. The Dorador had revealed the whole scheme to the Dey Hassan. When Cervantes saw what had befallen them, he charged his companions to lay all the blame upon him, and, as they were being bound, he declared aloud that the whole plot was of his contriving, and that nobody else had any share in it. Brought before the Dey, he said the same. He was threatened with impalement and with torture, and as cutting off ears and noses were playful freaks with the Algerines, it may be conceived what their tortures were like. But nothing could make him swerve from his original statement that he alone was responsible. The upshot was that the unhappy gardener was hanged by his master, and the prisoners taken possession of by the Dey, who, however, afterwards restored most of them to their masters, but kept Cervantes, paying Dali Mami 500 crowns for him. He felt no doubt that a man of such resource, energy, and daring was too dangerous a piece of property to be left in private hands, and he had him heavily ironed and lodged in his own prison. If he thought that by these means he could break the spirit or shake the resolution of his prisoner, he was soon undeceived, for Cervantes contrived before long to dispatch a letter to the governor of Oran, entreating him to send him some one who could be trusted, to enable him and three other gentlemen, fellow-captives of his, to make their escape, intending evidently to renew his first attempt with a more trustworthy guide. Unfortunately, the Moor who carried the letter was stopped just outside of Oran, and the letter being found upon him, he was sent back to Algiers, where, by the order of the Dey, was promptly impaled as a warning to others, while Cervantes was condemned to receive 2,000 blows of the stick, a number which most likely would have deprived the world of Don Quixote, had not some persons, who they were we know not, interceded on his behalf. After this he seems to have been kept in still closer confinement than before, for nearly 2 years passed before he made another attempt. This time his plan was to purchase, by the aid of a Spanish renegade and two Valencian merchants resident in Algiers, an armed vessel in which he and about 60 of the leading captives were to make their escape. But just as they were about to put it into execution, one Dr. Juan Blanco de Paz, an ecclesiastic and a compatriot, informed the Dey of the plot. Cervantes, by force of character, by his self-devotion, by his untiring energy and his exertions to lighten the lot of his companions in misery, had endeared himself to all and become the leading spirit in the captive colony, and, incredible as it may seem, jealousy of his influence and the esteem in which he was held moved this man to compass his destruction by a cruel death. The merchants, finding that the Dey knew all, and fearing that Cervantes under torture might make disclosures that would imperil their own lives, tried to persuade him to slip away on board a vessel that was on the point of sailing for Spain. But he told them that they had nothing to fear, for no tortures would make him compromise anybody, and he went at once and gave himself up to the Dey. As before, the Dey tried to force him to name his accomplices. Everything was made ready for his immediate execution. The halter was put round his neck, his hands tied behind him. But all that could be got from him was that he himself, with the help of four gentlemen who had since left Algiers, had arranged the whole, and that the 60 who were to accompany him were not to know anything of it until the last moment. Finding he could make nothing of him, the Dey sent him back to prison, more heavily ironed than before. The poverty-stricken Cervantes family had been all this time trying once more to raise the ransom money, and at last a sum of 300 ducats was got together and entrusted to the Redemptorist Father Juan Gil, who was about to sail for Algiers. The Dey, however, demanded more than double the sum offered, and as his term of office had expired, and he was about to sail for Constantinople, taking all his slaves with him, the case of Cervantes was critical. He was already on board, heavily ironed, when the Dey at length agreed to reduce his demand by one half, and Father Gil, by borrowing, was able to make up that amount, and on September 19th, 1580, after a captivity of 5 years, all but a week, Cervantes was at last set free. Before long he discovered that Blanco de Paz, who claimed to be an officer of the Inquisition, was now concocting on false evidence a charge of misconduct to be brought against him when he returned to Spain. To checkmate him, Cervantes drew up a series of 25 questions, covering the whole period of his captivity, upon which he requested Father Gil to make depositions of credible witnesses before a notary. 11 witnesses, taken from among the principal captives in Algiers, deposed to all the facts above stated, and to a great deal more besides. There is something touching in the admiration, love, and gratitude we see struggling to find expression in the formal language of the notary, as they testify one after another to the good deeds of Cervantes, how he comforted and helped the weak-hearted, how he kept up their drooping courage, how he shared his poor purse with this disponent, and how in him this disponent found father and mother. On his return to Spain, he found his old regiment about to march off to Portugal to support Philip's claim to the crown, and utterly penniless now, he had no choice but to rejoin it. He was in the expeditions to the Azores in 1582, and the following year, and on the conclusion of the war, returned to Spain in the autumn of 1583, bringing with him the manuscript of his pastoral romance, the Galatea, and probably also, to judge by internal evidence, that of the first portion of Persiles and Sigismunda. He also brought back with him, his biographers assert, an infant daughter, the offspring of an amour, as some of them with great circumstantiality inform us, with a Lisbon lady of noble birth, whose name, however, as well as that of the street she lived in, they omit to mention. The sole foundation for all this is that in 1605 there certainly was living in the family of Cervantes a Dona Isabel de Saavedra, who is described in an official document as his natural daughter, and then 20 years of age. So ends the first part of the translator's preface.